This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Let's check with the folks at Franciscan Health in the Northern Division to find about, among other things, the status of how the hospitals in the region are dealing with the COVID-19 pandemic. Robert Blaskowitz is the fellow who's in charge of communications and media relations. We talk with him occasionally in setting up interviews that we had here on Regionally Speaking, but we get to talk with Robert today in particular about these issues. Thanks very much for joining us on the show, first off.
Thank you, Chris. Happy to be here.
Well, let's talk first about something of importance. Franciscan Health is working with City of Crown Point and getting a blood drive sponsored. And these are of very urgent nature these days, I understand.
Yeah, we regularly sponsor blood drives at Franciscan, but typically they've been inviting the public into the hospital, and during the COVID crisis, we haven't been able to do that. We've had blood drives in the hospitals, but they've been staff only.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that's been the case nationwide, where you've just had, due to the pandemic, you've had this drop-off in public blood drives and blood donations, so we're really thrilled to be able to partner with the City of Crown Point to host a blood drive at Bulldog Park. It will be from 9 a.m. to 2 p.m. on Tuesday, June 23rd, so next Tuesday.
This is a case where it's really urgent in nature, and we've talked about this and had opportunities to talk with folks from the blood banks about the fact that there is such an urgent need for blood of all the types these days because of the pandemic. It's just almost gotten not quite out of hand, but pretty close to it, I would imagine.
Yeah, well, there's an urgent need not only for the pandemic, but also because hospitals are now opening up again, and we've begun doing elective surgeries again, so there are more of these procedures that require blood. So that's where you're seeing an increased need, and we're hoping that this drive on Tuesday will kind of help us meet that need.
Tell us, if you will, how the hospitals covered by Franciscan Health are doing these days within the region, dealing with the coronavirus pandemic. We know that there was at the start of the pandemic, when it really was taking hold here in Northwest Indiana, there were some concerns about being able to handle patients that might have to come in either through emergency department or just having to be checked in. How are things lately dealing with the issues?
Things have definitely improved. We've definitely seen a drop-off in the number of COVID cases we have in our hospital, probably in the lowest numbers that we've seen probably since early April. So it's definitely improved. Of course, during the height of the crisis, we were concerned about that surge, concerned about supplies of PPE, ventilators, that kind of thing. Luckily, we were able to work through that surge, and now we're seeing that drop off, and it's enabled us to, like I said, open up some of the our hospitals to other procedures and to other patients.
Mm-hmm. Are you finding, though, that that the hospitals and all the staff members at all of the Franciscan Health facilities are kind of standing by, hoping that there won't be a second wave of infections?
Absolutely. It's something that we are currently planning on. You kind of plan for the worst. And that's certainly what we have in mind with our PPE supplies. We're continuing to conserve and keep an eye on those kinds of things and watch what's happening. And we keep an eye on the numbers every day, obviously. The state does a good job of reporting those, and we have our own internal numbers and seeing what our hospitals are seeing. But we definitely are concerned, that it could come back in the fall. We just don't know.
Mm-hmm. We're talking with Robert Blaskowitz, who is the spokesperson for the Franciscan Health Northern Division, which is based here out of Lake County, and the hospitals here that are served by Franciscan Health. We know that there was a lot of work and preparation all of a sudden that had to go on within the facilities to deal with this. What kind of changes, other than some obvious ones, will folks note, or they have noted already for that matter, there at the facilities because of the pandemic and just trying to stay ahead of things?
Right. Well, the obvious, we instituted stricter visitor restrictions, and we're actually looking at maybe being able to relax those a bit, allow more visitors in the hospitals, but still maintaining the masking requirements and the screenings for temperatures and those kinds of things at the entrance. So we're really trying to maintain the safety, but also, we know that there are benefits to patients having visitors. So we want to kind of balance those things. I'd say the other aspect of what we've experienced here is virtual care. Virtual care is something, you know, telephonic care and video conferencing care, something we were moving toward anyway. It was really accelerated by the pandemic and the need to continue to treat patients, consult patients, but being able to do it virtually.
I've noticed that as well at home. Some of my family members take advantage of that opportunity. They have physicians and specialists that they stay in touch with on a regular basis with Franciscan Health, and they almost appreciate the fact that instead of having to make a trek in, they can actually do it on the phone from home.
Yeah, it's a real benefit to those, you know, especially those vulnerable patients who are better off staying at home. We want them to stay at home, but we want them to continue to get the care that they need. Since our response to COVID-19 has included over 100,000 telemedicine visits. So that's a big number, and we're really proud of the fact that we've been awarded by the FCC. The FCC has a COVID-19 telehealth program, which is part of the CARES Act passed by Congress. And Franciscan Alliance is receiving $929,000 from the program. And that goes to help purchase laptops, tablets, webcams, headsets, just those kinds of things that make these virtual visits possible.
And I know we're all hoping that there'll be an end to the pandemic, or at least certainly an abating of it. Do you think, and do others that you work with there at Franciscan Health think that in light of the fact that so much has been shifted over to telehealth, that they may just continue these services on?
Absolutely. I think we're seeing what we're seeing is a change that will become permanent, I think, in a lot of ways. It's a convenient way for patients to get their care. And we're also seeing added benefits. We're doing what we call virtual rounds. We're beginning to do those at our hospitals, where we're bringing in a team of clinicians to consult on a patient. And they're able to do that virtually as well, and it's really a great way to add to a patient's care.
We know this is a very stressful time for everybody who happens to be a first responder, including the EMTs and, of course, law enforcement and fire, but especially for the emergency folks that work in hospitals. And I'm sure that the emergency department people and the doctors and nurses and other technicians probably are doing their best to hang on. Are they doing pretty well, right, as far as you know?
You know what, they're doing well, and we have to really thank the community for the support that they provided from the beginning. We just had so many messages of encouragement and the donations of PPE that we were provided, the food that was provided to our staff members who are working so hard. And what we've done in all our hospitals is we've put up walls of what we're calling walls of gratitude. Mm-hmm. And these are walls basically where we can post messages from the public, pictures that have been drawn by kids, just things that are inspiring messages that, you know, when nurses or doctors or staff members get some downtime, they can go there to kind of look at and read these messages, look at these pictures, and kind of recharge their batteries, because it's a long battle. We're going to be in it for a while.
Well, it's great to hear, and let's hope that that the average person, if they do get a chance to come back to the Franciscan Health facilities on a regular basis or just an occasional visit, they have a chance to check out these walls of gratitude and see what people have had to say for sure themselves about all the work that's been done. And thanks for being with us to talk about it today, Robert.
I thank you, and just encourage anyone, if they're interested in donating at Crown Point, donating blood, they can set up an appointment by calling 1-800-7-TO-GIVE.
Once again, that's a blood drive that's being co-sponsored by Franciscan Health and the City of Crown Point. It's going to be held on the 23rd at Bulldog Park in Crown Point. And Robert Blaskowitz is a spokesperson for Franciscan Health in the Northern Division. One of the enduring symbols of the COVID-19 crisis is the homemade mask. Around the country, people have been sewing cloth masks for healthcare workers, community members, and themselves. Their volunteer work is a piece of larger U.S. history. SideFX Public Media's Stephanie Whitesides visits one of those volunteers at work behind a sewing machine.
Karina Neal is a photographer in the southern Illinois city of Carterville. Her business has been closed during the coronavirus pandemic, but she's kept busy with her brother's sewing machine.
I started making masks for my husband, who is a healthcare worker, and then for my elderly neighbors and more friends.
As the coronavirus intensified, more requests came in, and Neal got busier and busier.
And until the doctor from SIH asked me if I can help them make masks out from OR drapes. And at that point, I said, like, wow, I'm going to need help for this.
Now Neal leads a sewing group of 11 women. They've made hundreds of masks for the community. The volunteer work they're doing is part of a long history of women taking up needles and thread as an act of service. Laura Kidd is a professor with the Fashion Design and Merchandising Program at Southern Illinois University.
During the Revolutionary War, it became an act of patriotism for women to spin their own yarns and produce their own clothing, the cloth and then the clothing.
At the time, most women knew how to knit and sew. During wartime, there were other large-scale campaigns. Women knit socks and bandages for soldiers. The 1918 flu epidemic prompted the Red Cross to encourage women to sew masks, something Kidd says is very similar to what's happening today.
Because there are many people that were against wearing masks, but many people thought that wearing masks was good. So there was still that kind of fight, is it a good thing or a bad thing to wear?
Over time, though, these sewing and knitting campaigns became less common. Wartime supplies came from industry, not individuals. Handcrafts also lost popularity, says Kidd.
Of course, when World War II ended, all of these handcrafts sort of fell by the way. It kind of was relegated, and it wasn't really considered patriotic to knit anymore.
Knitting and sewing have seen a surge of renewed interest in recent years. Neal learned to sew when her daughter was younger and wanted a pink coat. Neal couldn't find one in stores, so she designed one herself. Then, years later, the coronavirus pandemic hit.
To be honest, I have never made masks before, but since I knew the basics of sewing, I said, like, I don't think it's going to be difficult. And it's not, you know.
Some masks from Neal's sewing group are made from regular cotton fabric. They're donated to anyone in need, elderly neighbors, police officers, essential workers. The patterns range widely from flowers to flags to paw prints. They use materials that are donated, dropped off on front porches, or picked up from local sewing stores. Chuck Clark owns Calico Country Sew and Vac in Southern Illinois. He started offering free fabric packs, leaving them outside the closed store.
So it's totally on the honor system. There's a box on the front porch, and there's a sign on the box that says that there's bags for making masks for healthcare workers.
Other fabrics have come from local sewers, along with the elastic and wire needed to make more closely fitted masks. Neal's group also makes another type of mask for healthcare workers. Those use surgical drape from Southern Illinois Healthcare and go to the staff there.
They also are scared of being infected. They also have families to go back to, and maybe just a little mask, like, kind of going to brighten up their day because somebody's thinking about them. Somebody is caring about them.
Steph Whiteside for Side Effects Public Media.
You're listening to Regionally Speaking on listener-supported Lakeshore Public Radio. Northwest Indiana community activist Ruth Needleman is with us to bring us up to date on what's happening in Northwest Indiana as far as some of the major issues, including immigration and the like, are concerned. And Ruth, thank you for joining us on the program today.
Totally my pleasure.
Well, a lot has happened, a lot of that on the national level in particular, with some decisions coming from the U.S. Supreme Court to have an impact here on Northwest Indiana. And, of course, the local protests as well, too. I'll let you kind of bring us up to date on how things shape up, especially locally.
Okay, I want to start talking about three local organizations that have been very active and outspoken. One, of course, is Black Lives Matter, Gary. And they have worked for, God, a very long time, years and years, to get a police accountability board that has provided some oversight. And it ran into a lot of problems with Mayor Karen because she just didn't want anyone to participate who had a real stake in the issue. For example, Black Lives Matter, people who had been incarcerated, people who had bad encounters. And now Gary Mayor Jerome Prince announced that he is going to establish a police advisory commission. And Black Lives Matter wrote a statement on it, which they welcome, but they also point out this commission is going to do another study and write another report, and it says nothing about policy change. And it also says nothing about who will be on this so-called police advisory commission. And what Black Lives Matter is calling for is, even if all you do is a study, at least include a spectrum of people in the community who have personal experiences and knowledge of the police, because we've had our own number of police cop killings of young people. Vincent Smith in 2006, Rashad Cunningham and Malvin Buller just last year. And nothing has happened to the police who killed them, not yet. So they would like an independent civilian-led review board that includes people who have had experiences, especially young people, who are the ones that often fall victim to police violence. And so that's very important. And I just have to tell you a little story that happened to me this morning in relationship to it. Mm-hmm. I did my grocery shopping at 7:30, carefully, and I talked to the cashier, who was wearing a mask, and I said, it's a shame how many people don't wear masks. She said, I find it much worse and scarier, these people who are tearing down statues. Well, that silenced me, because statues of traitors versus the lives of young people. What a comparison. She's afraid of, what, a Confederate statue coming down, but she's not afraid of people not wearing masks. And I think it's important to stress that police violence and the coronavirus are with us and must be addressed. And there are organizations working on it. And BLM, and you should go to their website, they have an entire alternative proposal for an ordinance to establish an independent civilian review board. Plus, they also have a statement on Mayor Jerome Prince's press release for a commission. The second group is the Coalition for a Community Benefits Agreement. There have been people in the Gary community and in Northwest Indiana in general who have spent many years pushing this idea that when development comes to Gary, it's not development if no one in Gary benefits. It's a ripoff. And so we have, again, another situation. Last year, the coalition got an actual resolution passed and an ordinance demanding that when people come here to build, they have to hire locally. They have to invest in not only the workers, but also in the community where they're building. And now there's a project happening on Broadway where they want to take HUD building and turn it into housing. And the developer says they want low-cost housing, but then in the next breath they said they want condominiums. And so the coalition has been setting up meetings with people in community, with the developer, with the economic development company, because too much of the development that has taken place brings no benefits to the Gary community. They don't hire locally, they don't train workers so they can take those jobs, and especially they don't invest in the surrounding community. So this coalition hopefully will be meeting this week with the developer and also with people from the city government, trying to make sure that this ordinance that was passed actually gets complied with, because since the mayor was elected, he's been trying to step away from it. He does not think community benefit agreements are good, even though all over the country they have been seen as one of the most important instruments for actually bringing benefits to the community. The third organization, which is national but has local committees, is called Cosecha. It means harvest in Spanish. Cosecha has been giving incredible help to families who have incarcerated, detained, and deported members. And they help people deal with the problems, communicate, legal help, family help, food, everything. And so I urge people, especially given the recent Supreme Court decision on DACA, that says you can't end a program that helps people who came here as little kids from getting citizenship because they didn't go about it right. So it's possible, and Trump is threatening to go back to the Supreme Court again and try to send the 700,000 people, many of whom now are frontline healthcare workers, nurses, doctors, lawyers. He wants to get them out of the country, whereas the vast majority of the population thinks they should be allowed to stay. And so it's a good decision, but it's a very temporary one. The other Supreme Court decision was much clearer and I think critical. It said that if you discriminate against somebody because they are lesbian, gay, transgendered, bisexual, whatever, based on their gender or their self-identification, that is, in the workplace, discrimination based on sex and is illegal. And that was a huge decision because so many people lose their jobs just for being who they are. And so that was a good one. DOC is coming back to us. And the other thing I want to flag for people here in Northwest Indiana, there is a publisher in Chicago called Haymarket Books. And Haymarket Books has been putting on some of the most wonderful digital panels. In other words, for free, you can listen to some of the best activists and thinkers in the country on a broad range of issues. And I think it's a great service. And if you get bored, just go to Haymarket Books online and see what's coming up. I watched one on police unions. I watched one on intersectionality. I've watched actually quite a few of them. And so that's very, very important as well.
Have you had an opportunity to catch any of the documentaries that are available on television these days since you've had opportunities?
Oh, my God, I've watched all of them.
Well, that's why I thought you're stuck at home a lot of the time, like many of us are in some respects, so you have a chance to get caught up on these documentaries. And if you happen to have the right streaming software, you can have a wealth of programs and channels to choose from.
There are so many old and new ones that are of immediate interest. For example, a long time ago, I watched Who Murdered Malcolm X. It's a documentary, and it's based on this incredible research into exactly what happened when he was killed. And I'm not going to tell you what they found because it is so dramatic, it is so engaging, and it's really well done. It's a multi-part series on Netflix. There's also been, and I'm going to forget, I do have a list. Next time I'll type up my list ahead of time. But there's been wonderful, wonderful documentaries on various leading people, on different issues. Let me give it some thought. I'll come back with a list. The brain doesn't work too fast.
Okay.
But there are quite a few. I mainly watch Netflix and Amazon Prime. There's been some wonderful ones on jazz musicians. There was one, I'm going to forget his name because that's what my brain does now. But if you like good jazz, check out your favorite performers by looking at Netflix. There's a Miles Davis one that I just loved. Of course, the soundtrack is brilliant. And for lightheartedness, there was a wonderful little movie, not a documentary, called Uncorked, like you uncork a bottle. Mm-hmm. And it's about a young man whose father and grandfather own barbecue in the city. And, of course, his father wants him to take over the barbecue. But this young man, African-American, actually wants to be what's called a sommelier, who's a connoisseur of wines. So out of the ordinary. And so it's a delightful movie. You'll learn a lot about wine you never knew. And you'll also enjoy the dynamics of this family. Highly recommended.
I know we mentioned before we got together today about a kind of a little review that you were thinking about doing on a book that you'd read involving a genocide and slavery history.
Oh, my God, this book. Mm-hmm. This is a must read.
Okay.
It's not easy, but this historian tells a story. He's not one of those people that rambles on, gets abstract. He tells the story of this country and how its entire development has been rooted in white supremacy and genocide. And he tells things that I never knew, that there were whole Confederate battalions that fought in the War of 1898 when we stole the Philippines, Cuba, and Puerto Rico from Spain and from their own independence. He also... Here's something I definitely didn't know. In the Vietnam War, these same Southern brigades were still flying the Confederate flag. So for people who think that there's no continuity in white supremacy and in the elimination of communities, nations, and people of color, need to look at this book because he tells a really good story. He's one of the most knowledgeable historians I've ever met, and he writes clearly, and you won't believe what you'll learn in this book, and it really helps to clarify, you know, why are these people who are white supremacists, walk around with guns, support our current president, also think that it's a violation of their rights to wear a mask or to be told to stay at home. And he talks about the emergence of the concept of individual rights up against the common good. In other words, just because it's good for the majority, you can't force me to wear a mask. You can't force me to not open my store. You can't force me to stay at home. It's a sense of entitlement that is rooted in our past and is leading, as it has always done, to dire consequences.
Is it possible?
Oh, the book.
I was going to ask next.
Yeah, the End of the Myth. And the author's name is Greg, and his last name is Grandin, Grandin. It's a paperback. It's not that expensive. You can also probably get it, you know, digital, but I can't read a book like that digitally. Mm-hmm. I need to underline and put in my comments and be able to go back and forth, and I don't know how to do that.
Well, that's from all your years of being an academician, I guess, having to handle books, literally handle books and be able to work with them, I suppose.
Right. Well, and also when I'm writing, I'm still working on my book. Mm-hmm. I have to take notes, I have to organize my notes, and when I write, I have to have all these papers in front of me so I can bring in data from different sources to support an argument or a description that I'm doing. And so he does a wonderful job of this,
well,
because his examples are so clear and many of them totally unknown to most people.
Well, Ruth, next time we get together on Regionally Speaking, we're going to have to spend more time talking and get your list of documentaries together and go down some of these that you've had a chance to check out, and I'm sure there are probably others you've probably have discovered since then as well, too. Thanks for spending time with us to talk today.
Absolutely, and you have a very safe week.
Thank you. You too. Northwest Indiana community activist Ruth Needleman. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thank you for joining us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.